It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Money Nerds Podcast, where owning a calculator, budgeting your money, and having a net worth is actually cool. I'm your host, Whitney Hansen, and each week I'll be chatting with inspiring people to learn their secrets to financial success. Now let's dive into the show.
Hey, Money Nerds, have you ever just did a quick scroll on YouTube to see all of the different styles of real estate investing? It is insane how many different styles there are. So no wonder there's so much confusion around which one should I do? Should it be short-term rentals? What about midterm rentals? What about long-term rentals? Should I not do any of these? Should I house hack? Should I just do syndications? There are so many different options, and I completely understand why that can get so overwhelming, especially if you're new to investing. And that's why I wanted to bring on Dave Meyer, because he is truly a real estate expert, and he does a really good job of just helping you understand what strategy is going to be best for you. If you aren't familiar with Dave Meyer, he has spent his career working in technology industry while also investing in real estate. In 2016, he took the opportunity to combine his passions for real estate and technology and join Bigger Pockets, where he now serves as the VP of Market Intelligence. He's the author of Start with Strategy and Real Estate by the Numbers. Dave has been a rental property investor in Colorado since 2010 and invests passively nationwide. He's also the host of Bigger Pockets It's on the Market podcast, which started in 2022 and is growing rapidly as a one-stop source for all things real estate analytics. He currently lives in Amsterdam, Netherlands. In this episode, we cover a lot of ground. We talk about different styles of real estate investing and how you don't always have to quit your job and go all in on real estate investing, and why this can still be for you, even if you would prefer to be a little bit more hands-off. Filtering your criteria for investing in real estate, advice for investors very early on in their career, what we are seeing for the market in 2024. He shares some really good perspectives that I think are helpful when you're going into looking into properties. Tips for finding a good agent. This one is so key. He also talks about red flags with business partners and portfolio management, including two often overlooked steps. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode as much as I did. I learned a ton, and more than anything, I was very much reminded of the importance of starting with strategy. So let's go ahead and dive into this conversation with Dave Meyer. Hey, Dave, thank you so much for hanging out.
Thank you so much for having me, Whitney.
I am pumped to be here with you. So first and foremost, congratulations on your book, Start With Strategy. Tell us a little bit about why you decided to write this book.
I wrote Start With Strategy to help people of really all experience levels and background figure out how to use real estate to improve their financial position. And there are so many different ways that you can use real estate to get ahead financially, but that can be a little bit overwhelming. And so the idea behind the book is to help match the right real estate investing strategies and tactics to your individual goals and circumstances.
I love that you decided to write this because it does seem very overwhelming when you have all of the different strategies. We're hearing short-term and long-term and REITs and all of these. We're like, oh my God, where do I even start? So take us back a little ways. What was your entry point into real estate investing?
I started investing in real estate about a year out of college. It was 2010 and I was waiting tables and had a desire to achieve some level of financial stability, financial independence, and was just kind of looking for side hustles, honestly, at the time. And a friend of mine introduced me to the concept, and he was doing it really poorly, but still making a lot of money. And I was like, man, I feel like I could do this a little bit better. Yeah. And so I learned as much as I could about real estate investing, spent a lot of time just looking for deals and reading everything I could, and was able to attract some partners because I didn't have the money to put down a down payment myself, and was able to get a fourplex in Denver as my first deal. And that was 14 years ago, and I've been doing it ever since.
That's incredible. Okay, so you mentioned attracting investors for the first deal, which I think for a lot of people hear that, they're like, oh my God, that seems like so unheard of. How did you do that? Like, who were the investors? Did you know them? Were they strangers? What was the process like?
Not strangers. So I think that is, you know, I was very lucky to have two friends and one family member who were able to go four ways into it. So we split it a lot of ways. We were mostly young people, but not everyone has that situation. I understand that it's fortunate to know people, you know, who had good jobs and good income and who were able to do that better than me, at least at that point. And so that was really lucky. But it is the way I think a lot of people do get started, is if you do the work to sort of learn the industry and can demonstrate proficiency and that you know how to run a deal and you've identified a good deal, it is possible to attract capital. But again, we can talk about this later, but in the book, attracting capital is not the only way to get started. It's just that's how I did.
So the first fourplex, where'd you find it? Was it through a real estate agent? Did you go knock on doors? Like, how did you come across that?
It was through a real estate agent. This was, again, 2010. So prices were really pretty low, especially in Denver. And so I did find it through a real estate agent. I was actually, another side hustle I was doing at the time was I was cold calling for a real estate agent tenant rep. It was terrible. I hated it. But I met a couple of brokers. I was working for a commercial broker, but I met a residential broker through that experience, and he helped me find that deal.
Oh my gosh. How did you get the side hustle of doing the cold calling? Was that you just did a cold call yourself?
I don't even remember. I think when I moved to Denver, someone I knew just like introduced me to this woman. I don't even remember, so long ago, but it was like a friend of a friend kind of situation. And maybe even more than that, because I was like, you know, in 2010, the benefit was real estate was cheap, but it was really hard to find a job. And I was a year out of college. I was just trying to find a job. And so I was just calling everyone. And this one, I think it paid $8 an hour. And I was just, got me kind of interested in real estate though. So it definitely helped move my career along.
Those weird side hustle tangents, man, you never know where they're going to lead you. I'm such a fan of that for that reason. Okay. So you've got your fourplex, and then what was your journey? Like how many, what is it? We say doors. Is that the correct term? Like how many doors do you have? Like what's your strategy now? Like what are you up to?
Yeah. So from that point, I did buy a few more rental properties in Denver over the course of about 8 years. But 4 years ago, I wound up moving to Europe. I live in Amsterdam. So I had to switch my strategy. And so I don't really know how many doors I have because I invest mostly passively now. So I'm in a whole bunch of multifamily syndications, lending funds. And so I've really diversified my strategy outside of just owning directly, but I do still own a couple of rental properties in Denver and one short-term rental as well.
Oh, very fun. Yeah, I feel like for a lot of people, the idea of real estate investing is so scary because it seems like a lot of risk. Am I going to get that phone call at midnight about the toilet? And like, I think we all go through the exact same narrative. It's always the same story in our head. It's so funny. But I'm really generally interested. Like, do you find for most real estate investors, is the starting place to go through that, to have a couple single family properties, maybe a short-term rental, and then scale up to syndications? Like, what is your thought process there?
Yeah, I think it's really unique to everyone. And part of the book helps you identify where you fall on this spectrum. But I do think it depends on your individual goals. Like if you are someone who is entrepreneurial, I think the best way to get started is probably something called house hacking. If you've heard of that, it's basically an owner-occupied rental property. It offers tons of financial advantages, like better financing, better mortgages. And it's just a great sort of like training wheels. It's really low risk, and it's a really good way to reduce your living expenses and learn the industry. From there, most people sort of go on to acquire a couple of rental properties, or if you have more time on your hands, then you learn to do the renovation side of the business, which is very profitable, but I don't really do it because it's too much work. So I think a lot of people get started that way. I think the other side of things, though, is that a lot of people just want to work in their job, or maybe it's a high paying job or it gives them good benefits. And then you can just start with like either syndications or what's known as turnkey investing, which is basically buying a property that's already, you know, basically set up right to be a rental property. And so it really depends on what you're looking for. I think that's honestly the beauty of real estate, is like you could really customize it to whatever situation you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, I think that's so true too. Like my personal style of real estate investing is unique Airbnbs and like truly going in and building them. I freaking love it. People see that and they're like, I'm not picking up a jackhammer for the life of me. And I'm like, no, it's fun. It's cool. But I do recognize that there are so many different strategies. So once you identify your strategy and you go through the book and it helps you figure out like, this is the type of investor that I choose to be, what's the next step? Like you have this concept of like a buy box. Is that where we go next?
Yeah. And let me just say, this is a perfect example because you doing unique Airbnb is like, that is my nightmare. I love staying at them, but like I did one short-term rental and furnishing it was like the worst experience I've had as a real estate investor. I absolutely hated it. It just wasn't for me. It's not something I like love. You know, some people do it. It's a lot of work. And then they see the end product. They're like, oh, this is amazing. I was like, I hate this. So I still have it. It's good, but it was just a pain in the butt. But I think once you sort of identify what your situation is, you need to go through basically a filtering mechanism to narrow down of all these great options for investing in real estate, which ones are best aligned with me and my personal goals. And that is super important, I think, especially in today's day and age, because if you go on Instagram or YouTube, you'll hear about all these different strategies. And that's not a bad thing. They are all legit. Most of them, I should say, are legitimate strategies, but it can be super overwhelming. I mean, I, as a job, talk to real estate investors on a podcast all day. And I'm like, man, I want to do what that person's doing. I want to do what she's doing. And I get all this FOMO. And I imagine for regular people, like that's super overwhelming. And so I think it's really important to just sit down and say like, okay, short-term rentals are for me. Like that's something I'm passionate about. But flipping, that's too much work. It's too much risk. It's not aligned with my risk tolerance or what I'm trying to accomplish. And although it's cool, and although I'm going to see some other people I know making good money doing that, that one is not for me. And that sort of helps you get over this. Some people call it analysis paralysis or just this decision fatigue, you know, and I think it really can be helpful in just narrowing your focus so you can just concentrate on learning a couple strategies that are going to be really good for you and your personal goals.
When people are going through this filtering process, do you feel like, is it kind of one of these things where we should put our blinders on and ignore any other deal? So if we're looking through the MLS or Zillow, or we're driving around neighborhoods and we know our strategy is duplexes, that's where we want to be first, and you see this really great cabin off to the side and you're like, oh my gosh, like, should we still even entertain that? Or do you think it's like blinders only focus on one thing?
I think it depends where you are in your investing career. Early in your career, if it's your first couple of deals, I really do think the blinders are helpful. To just pick one thing, get good at it. Yeah. Once you have a couple of deals under your belt and perhaps a network, which is super important, like having a team around you. Once you have that, you can, I think, open up your deal, what I call deal design in the book, but open up your options for deals, basically. So there are different ways to scale. But for me, like even if I'm looking for properties, I see a flip, I ignore it all the time. Flipping is just not for me. But like, I'll consider a long-term rental. I'll consider a BRRRR, which is like a rental property with a renovation. kitchen, I would consider another short-term rental. I would just hire someone to furnish it. instead of doing it myself. And so I sort of have opened up to a bit more, but I still think the key is to know, like, okay, I will consider three options, but not all nine different options, because otherwise it's just too much choice. And I think people think that they want a lot of choice and optionality, but there's this great book called The Paradox of Choice. And it just shows that when you have too much choice, you just decide nothing, you get stuck. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really important to limit your optionality. And that actually helps you move quicker.
Paint me a picture of this like filtering process that you go through. Like what exactly is included in that?
So I have eight different elements of what I call deal design. And in real estate, people often call it, quote unquote, finding a deal.
Yeah.
And that's important, right? You know, identifying the actual parcel of land, the physical property that you're going to buy is really a crucial thing. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot more to creating a deal than just picking the property. So one, you can have a property and then, you know, decide if you want to flip it, rent it, short-term rental it. And so that's the first step. I call that called the deal type. Like, what is the type of strategy that you're going to use? But then there's seven other elements that you need to go through. One is financing. So are you going to buy for cash? Are you going to use traditional mortgage? Are you going to use a DSCR loan, which is a debt service coverage ratio loan? It just helps you get underwritten if you don't have, for a lot of different reasons. I won't get into that. But different operational plans, what market you're going to invest in. I call it management plans. So like, are you going to actively manage it or passively manage it? And it sounds like a lot, but it's actually not. You just go through these eight different steps and be like, I'm into these three options for deal type. I'm into these two financing options. And then it sort of gives you this chart. Literally in the book, you can like write it out. There's like a planner, a business planner in there. And you can just say like, these are the things that I'm going to consider. And I think at the end of that, whether you read the book or not, that will just allow you to say like, okay, now when I'm talking to a real estate agent or I'm knocking on doors, like I can focus on just the things that make sense for me. And I find the visualization of it really helpful in sort of, you know, instilling that discipline about what deals you're going to look for.
No, I found that to be very helpful too. Like in that chart, I could see myself printing that off and just like going through that for practice. And just so, and I think eventually you probably do it in your head. I'm sure you do. But like people like me, where we're very new to this, it's probably best to jot it out. And there's nothing wrong with that.
I still write it out.
I think
it's really helpful. Yeah. Like once a year, I think it's helpful to just like, I once a year put together a couple of different things I call an action plan. Mm-hmm. But I start with like an investment thesis, which is sort of my guardrails for the year.
Awesome.
So for this year, for example, I'm like, all right, I want to buy some rental properties because I think that rates are going to come down a little bit. And I think that it's going to get competitive again. And although prices might not go up a lot, I do think right now there's not a lot of competition. And I like that. Mm-hmm. I also invest a lot in commercial real estate, but I don't want to do that right now because it's in the middle of a price decline. And I'm just going to avoid that for 6 months. So just doing that, right? Just, I've done that in the last few weeks. So I've just gotten super active in the last few weeks because I now am like super clear about what I want to do this year. And so I use this, that's like my thesis. And then I sort of break that down into action steps. I'm like, okay, that means I need to call my agent and tell him what I want to buy and sort of like back into how I'm going to actually execute that. But I still think it's super useful to just do the exercise. Otherwise, to me, it just like keeps swirling in your head. You're like, oh, I could do that other thing. But like, sitting down and being like, nope, not doing commercial for 6 months, like it really allows me to sort of be more disciplined.
Well, okay. And I have to plug too, because so if somebody hasn't heard of you and like your background, you are very much a data guy. Like this is ingrained in you at this point. So tell us a little bit about, from your role at Bigger Pockets, like what is it that you do there?
Yeah, my title is the Vice President of Market Intelligence. So I just got a new title and I'm super excited about it. Thank you. I joined Bigger Pockets 8 years ago now. And originally I was investing in real estate, as I told you at the top of the show, but I my eventually got a full-time job in my chosen field, what I wanted to do, which was in tech. And so I got into data. I really liked data and analytics, and eventually got a job at BiggerPockets doing internal analytics, you know, working with the marketing team and the finance team and providing insights and analysis about the business. Then starting during COVID, I had always sort of applied this skill set to real estate too. But during COVID, like, people were really wondering what was going on. You know, had these forbearance programs and foreclosure moratoriums and all these things. So I just started writing about the data that I track, and that really took off. And so now my role at BiggerPockets is basically analyzing the housing market and the macroeconomic climate, and helping real estate investors understand what's going on, what strategies are working well, what markets are best for different approaches. So yeah, I am steeped in this and do it all day, every day.
That's incredible. And you kind of mentioned not doing commercial for like 6 months. So paint us a very quick picture, and then we're going to get back to your book for sure. But what are you seeing for 2024? You mentioned some rate drops. Like, what do you thinking is probably going to happen to the overall market?
Sure. I think, you know, there are a lot of questions about the market this year, and I don't know for sure. My general feeling is that I sort of gave a talk about this recently, and my hypothesis is that it all really comes down to affordability. Mm-hmm. Affordability is just a measurement of how easily the average American can afford the average priced home. And as of October, it was the lowest it's been since 1985. So that's not good. And so a lot of people leave the market. That reduces demand, as we say in economics. Right. It pulls it out of the market. And so that is why we've seen really slow sales. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we've seen not a lot of supply. And that is because it's not an attractive market to sell into either, because 70% of people who sell go on to buy. And so if it doesn't sound good to buy, it's probably not sounding so good to sell. And so we're in this situation right now where supply is low and demand is low. There are some indications right now that rates, they have come down a bit, but they've sort of leveled out. And I think what happens this year really depends on if rates keep going down. A lot of people think so. And if that happens, it's likely to become a more healthy market. I don't necessarily think that, like a lot of people think, that means prices are going to skyrocket back up. Yeah. But I do think what's going to happen is that we'll get more inventory on the market, more homes for sale, and more home purchases. And I think that's really important. You know, a lot of we in the media talk a lot about prices, but the volume of home sales is really important for the industry. And so I am hopeful that that's what happens. Yeah, that said, I am not as optimistic as a lot of people that we're going to get rates like in the fives this year. I think we're going to stay probably somewhere in the 6%. And so I think it will get better, but it's going to be gradual. And therefore, we'll see a relatively flat year. Now, that means, you know, if it goes up 3 or 4%, down 2 or 3%, I don't know. But I think we're probably going to be somewhere, you know, close to zero, relatively speaking, if we were to talk a year from now.
That'll be, let's do this a year from now. And
great.
I think it'd be fun. It'd be very interesting.
I just put out a video about all the things I got wrong and right. So I like doing that. I think
how did it go? Like, as a whole, were you like, not bad?
You know, I think I did well on like 4 out of 5 things, but the thing I got wrong was prices, which is what everyone cares about.
That's so hard.
I got interest rates right. But I thought in 2023, we would see prices go down like 2 or 3%.
I thought so too.
Yeah. I've never been a crash guy. I just don't, you know, the fundamentals don't support that idea. But I did think demand would just get weaker than it did and supply would stay a little bit higher. Yeah. So I like, you know, I forecast things and I got the curve right. Like I thought the first half would be weak and it would get better. But it got way better in the second half than I thought. And so got that one wrong. But I got a lot of the other pieces about rents and the other things. Right.
One of the things, okay, I know for a lot of people that hear, okay, interest rates are maybe going down, maybe 6%. I think there's almost a sunk cost fallacy where we remember the 2 to 3% rates and we're like, ooh, 6% is way too high. And I noticed this a lot too, you know, post 2008, people are like, oh no, that's way too high. Like, I'm not going to buy, you know? So we almost like get stuck on this rate. Do you find yourself, like, how do you walk people through that might be experiencing some of that?
Yeah, I mean, it is a lost opportunity. Like, you know, that was a once in a lifetime opportunity, I'll say. But don't let missing out on that sort of influence your future decisions. Mm-hmm. I am of the belief that it will be very unlikely that we see mortgage rates below 4% anytime soon. I don't think we'll ever see them below 3.5%, like maybe ever again in our lifetimes. And I could be wrong, but the only way that that happens is something goes really badly. Like, think about the last two times that we've gotten rates that low, COVID and the great financial crisis. And so those two times we experimented, and I say we, the Fed, experimented with what is now known as the zero interest rate policy, where they drop zero rates all the way to zero. That is not a common practice, or at least it wasn't before the last 15 years. And it sort of created this unique situation where mortgage rates were really low, and that certainly helped asset values in real estate. But I think we've seen that it, one, creates inflation, or at least in some instances. It didn't for the first 10 years, which is kind of surprising. But then it did certainly help with that and contribute to that during the last couple of years. And it also, there are evidence that there's a lot of other secondary negative outcomes, like income inequality, that it leads to stratification incomes. And so I think the Fed will be, I think they've learned their lesson a little bit, and I think they will be very hesitant to adopt a zero interest rate policy again, unless there is some really economic emergency. But again, that comes with a lot of negativity, so I'm not exactly rooting for that. So I will just say, over the last 50 years, the average mortgage rate is about 6%. And so, like, you have to think about, we're getting close to average. And I do think in the next few years, we might get into the fives. And so that will be, that is what you should consider a good buy. But I also think that the market has shown resilience, and it's normalizing around this like 6.5% rate. And so thinking that it's going to tank the market, there's, you know, I never believed in that. And now it's getting less and less likely that it's going to tank the market. And so I think people do need to sort of just get used to current rates. And there's a lot more I can talk about that, but that's my general thought.
I think that's actually very helpful to hear, because I do know that so often we do focus so much on the interest rate, and I get it. Like, it does affect your payment significantly. So I understand it, but I do see a lot of people miss out on deals because of that. They're like waiting for that perfect time. And whether that's an interest rate or a purchase price, like, it seems like we're always waiting for the right time. And I think that's why I like your book so much too, is it's very formulaic. It's like, no, here's how to do this. Like, and it gives you almost that peace of mind where it's, you can find the deal that works for your strategy and for your life that will still be a good deal for you, no matter what the market does. And so that is one of the things that I really appreciate about your book.
If you are a garden lover, you've got to listen up. Did you know Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the U.S.? They have everything you could possibly want, from fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Whatever you're interested in, they have it for you. Find the perfect fit for your climate and space. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. And along with their 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee, they offer free plant consultation forever. I ordered a couple plants. I know I've talked about them a few times on this podcast. I have some peaches and cream, honeysuckle vines, and an English ivy vine for the flower pot, and they are coming along so well. If you haven't been following along on Instagram, you're going to see them being planted, and I think it'll take a couple of years before they really get to the level that I want, where they drape over the flower pot, but they are so cool. Now, here's the cool thing too. This spring, they have the best deals online with up to half off select plants and other deals, and listeners to our show get an additional 15% off their first purchase when using code MONEYNERDS at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using code MONEYNERDS at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code MONEYNERDS. Offers valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Okay, hear me out. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet. So for me, this was my debit card. But what I realized is that I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. And now I've got a card with more miles and more upgrades, and I truly love it. Right now, I'm not doing too much traveling, but I am collecting all of those points so that I can hopefully take a really sweet vacation in the very near future. But I gotta know, what could future you do with more travel rewards? Would you do a hotel upgrade? Would you do lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. With all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms do apply.
I want to go back to, we were talking about your deal, and you have all of your filters, you've got all of your criteria, and then you're ready to start shopping. How do we find a good real estate agent that understands investing?
Well, my number one recommendation would be to use BiggerPockets. We do have a tool. If you go to biggerpockets.com/agent, we do have a directory of investor-friendly agents. These are people who specialize in working with investors, and it's free. You can just get matched. You tell them your criteria. But I do think it's important to know how to also vet those people. So we've done it at BiggerPockets, but you should know how to do this on your own anyway. Mm-hmm. I think the number one thing is, like, does the agent invest themselves? That's not saying that, like, not agents that don't invest can't be good. Actually, my agent in Colorado is not a big investor, but is an excellent investor-friendly agent. But I think they need to be able to at least speak the language of investors, and most of them don't. And that's not wrong. I mean, 80% of home purchases are for homes, you know, primary home buyers. So you have to think about that and find that someone who's worked with investors before and understand what you're looking for as an investor, because it's less about, frankly, emotion, and like how you feel in a home. Right. And it's more about the numbers and how well a good of an investment it is. And that's not a knock against emotion. Like, when you're buying your primary residence, you should feel good in it. I just mean for investors, it's just a different equation. Yeah. And so finding agents who really can point you to the right neighborhoods, have references for good property managers, good contractors, good lenders, are the kind of people that you want to be associating with.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense too. So then you can use a tool like BiggerPockets to help you find an agent. And then from there, you're able to go through, chat with people. Is this something where it's like normal contractor stuff, where it's like get 3 quotes and move on? Is that kind of similar to this? Or like, how many agents do you think we really truly need to be chatting with?
I think so. I just looked at 2 markets over the last couple of weeks I went to, and I talked to 2 in 1 and 3 in the other before. Nice. I went. And different people are looking for different things. Actually, the people I talked to, some of them were more deal oriented. Some of them are like, you know, work with wholesalers and focus on off-market deals. Mm-hmm. Some of them are, you know, a little more, are part of a boutique firm where they offer property management in-house. So like, there's, you know, they were all good agents, but I think you just need to kind of think about what you want. And by talking to a few of them, you'll be able to compare and contrast more easily and say, like, mm-hmm. okay, here's the pros and cons of this agent, pros and cons of this, which one's more aligned with me. A lot of them were good, but, you know, I personally, as an out-of-state investor, really like agents who have a well-groomed team that I can kind of just mm-hmm. adopt, like a property manager, a lender, contractors. Like, that's super important to me. And so that's often how I vet agents.
Fair enough. Okay. So when it comes to looking for the property, should we go get our agent first? Should we get our financing first? Like, what's the order of operations, and does it matter?
I think if you're new, it doesn't really matter. But I think I see a common mistake for new investors is to wait to get financing.
Yeah.
And it's funny because people are like, I don't know if I can qualify for that. Or like, that house is interesting, but I don't know. It's like, well, people will tell you for free. Just go talk to a lender and they will tell you if you can afford that house and how much it will cost. And it takes so much of the guessing out, but people wait till they've been looking at properties for months. Like, just go talk to a loan officer. They're all eager to share information with you. And that's super helpful. And if you do that and have that information and you give that to your agent, then you're in a really good position because you've told your agent exactly what you can afford. You'll have realistic expectations when you go out and start looking for properties. And then it just sort of streamlines the processes a bit. If you're more experienced, I should say, like, and you've done a few deals and you kind of know you'll get qualified, then it doesn't matter as much.
That's a good point. I've got a lot of pals that will find a deal and then they're like, oh, I found the deal of a lifetime. And then I'm going to go raise some money. I'm like, oh, this is so like different than what a lot of people do. You know, it's like, it seems so opposite. And I gotta ask like too, is even that a good strategy or should we always be a little bit more methodical about our financing?
I talk a lot about partnerships in the book, and I think partnerships are excellent. It is really common for people to partner.
Okay.
I will say that I think it's mostly common that people partner with people they know. I mean, you know, it is hard, I think, especially if you're a new investor, to go out there and just be able to like attract someone you don't know's money. Like, think about that. It would be hard for me to give my money to someone I don't know.
Heck yeah.
And so I think starting with friends and family, even if it's between a bunch of people, is a common and good way to get started. But you have to be really good at what you do to take on other people's money. It's a big responsibility.
It is.
And so you need to make sure that you really understand the details. And I highly recommend to people, even if it's friends and family, perhaps especially if it's friends and family, to get legal documents created that outline the details of your partnership in case you want to sell, in case one of you goes through financial difficulty. There are so many different things that can happen. And just knowing how you're going to handle adverse situations ahead of time can help preserve friendship and family, which is more important than any individual real estate deal. So highly recommend that. But I do think raising money from people is a good way to do it. It's a very common way to do it. It just needs to be done thoughtfully. Mm. And I do think there's a lot of media out there that makes it sound like you can just go and like raise money from random people. That happens, but you need to build a relationship with them. You can't go from like, I just met you, do you want to invest? It's going to take a while. And to your point about finding deals, like, you're going to need 6 months at least to do that and build those relationships and trust. So that if that's your strategy for financing, which is perfectly fine, you need to start that well in advance before you actually try and identify what property you're going to buy.
That's very helpful too. I think we don't talk nearly enough about partnerships and some of the legal structure around that and how it can be so challenging. And I think that's a very smart thing to do. And it almost feels like a prenup where people shun it and they don't want to talk about it. It's like, oh, that means I'm failing to, or it's planning to fail. And it's not the case at all. It's just giving you guys both a lot of respect and a good out in case something comes up. Like, life happens. So I do think it is interesting.
There's a great book called The Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel. And he said something that I love. He said, you should always plan for the plan to not go according to plan. And
yes.
I think it's a tongue twister, but it's so true. Like, I like to be prepared. And if it doesn't happen, fine. Then everything went well. And who cares that you spent the time? But like, not having a backup plan, and when things go wrong, it's just like getting kicked when you're down. You know, like something's going wrong and then you're not prepared for it. It's bad.
What are some of like your personal red flags with partnerships?
Honestly, I think that a lot of it just comes down to experience. Like, everyone needs to bring something to the table in a partnership. I think of real estate as having three key resources: the capital, money, time. And because real estate is a business, it's not a truly passive investment, and skill. Like, you need someone who knows how to operate a deal. And so I think it's really important to think about the different roles in a partnership. Mm-hmm. Now, is everyone going to bring money? Are some people going to bring money and time? Are some people just going to give time and skill? That's how I started, because I didn't have capital. And so I just think it's really important to outline those things at the beginning, because if you get started and two of you say, let's just give an example, you two partners go 50-50 and you just put in 50% of the money, but you don't talk about who's going to operate the deal, things can go wrong. And so I really think knowing what goes into a deal, like all the different tasks, all the different operational elements, it's not like crazy. I mean, it's just go through a list of stuff that, you know, thousands of other investors have put together and just determine who's going to do what. And if there's a partner who wants to get into a deal, but doesn't have money, but and doesn't have time and doesn't have experience, like that's probably not a good person to do it. If they don't have money and they want to contribute time, like do they actually have that time? Make sure that they're going to contribute it. I think that's really sort of the framework I use for every deal. And it's a good way to think through what partnerships might work.
That's very helpful. I appreciate you sharing that too. That gives us at least some more perspective of how to view the different contributions. And it's not always just money. I think sometimes when you don't have money, you feel like that's the ultimate contribution, then you devalue your time or your experience or whatever it might be. So I do think that is helpful to reframe. Once we have purchased our property, we've got it financed, whatever direction of financing we went through, and you give some really good suggestions in the book as well. Once we get through that piece, it comes to the management side. And I think that that's a very challenging piece too. So what are your favorite tips or tricks for running whatever version of property you have?
Yeah, the last part of strategy for me is what I just call portfolio management, which does include, you know, the fun stuff like acquiring new properties and figuring out which deals are going to complement your existing portfolio. But it also requires two really important steps that I think are often overlooked. The first is tracking and measuring the performance of your existing portfolio. And I know that sounds like everyone's going to do it, but a lot of people don't. And, you know, maybe they look at the total cash flow at the end of the year, but there are a lot of just useful metrics I talk about in the book, or you can learn about online, like your return on equity, for example, or your cash on cash return, or your IRR. And if you don't know what these means, that's okay. You can easily learn them. But basically learning how different deals are doing, because when you do that, you can say, maybe you own three properties. Maybe one of them is just lagging behind the other ones and you should sell it and buy something new. Or maybe one of them is taking up all of your time and it's not actually worth the effort that you're putting into it. So the first step, I think, for everyone is really just to go through the like a checklist of like how your portfolio is doing. And I provide one for free. It's Excel software at the book to do that. The second one is then you sort of have to look outside your portfolio and just consider what's going on in the market. Because, you know, as investors, we want to focus on things that we can control. Unfortunately, there are some things that we can't, and you just have to monitor them. And so that's understanding what's going on in the markets in which you invest and on a macroeconomic level. And I think these two really pair well together because, for example, if you go and see your portfolio is getting a 6% cash on cash return, and in your market, the average deal right now, because you're monitoring it, only gives a 3% cash on cash return, you're probably going to hold on to that property. And maybe instead of buying a new deal, you reinvest into your existing property to optimize your revenue. If, you know, instead you see that the average in your market is a 9% cash on cash return, maybe you should go sell that property or refinance the ones you have to buy something new because you can better use your resources. And that's really what portfolio management comes down to, is this adopting sort of a mindset of resource allocation and thinking constantly, those three resources I was talking about, time, capital, skill, like how do you optimize them all the time to be getting the most out of them in your real estate portfolio? And so that's, I think, a skill that takes some time to develop, but it's really good to start practicing it, even with your first deal, because it will really help you as you scale up your portfolio.
Why do you feel like people don't track that more frequently?
I think, generally speaking, one, most people don't have good bookkeeping. I know I didn't for a really long time.
It took me a while too.
Yeah, it is. It's like, at first you're just so excited. You're like, I made more money than I spent last month. That's awesome.
So you're just, we're doing good.
Yeah, so you're thrilled about it.
Yeah.
And that's a great place to start. And if it takes a little time, so be it. But I think eventually you really, to make the most of your portfolio, It's worth investing either in software like QuickBooks or a bookkeeper who can give you this type of information. It's just the same thing as, picking stocks or I'm sure in most people's jobs, they get data or information about their performance and it helps inform decision-making. And so I know it's kind of a pain in the butt, but it really does help and it's going to be worth it. This is anecdotal, but I would estimate that for almost everyone, the cost of getting bookkeeping done or tracking your portfolio will be more than offset by the opportunities you find and the optimizations you're able to do by tracking your portfolio.
Gosh, that's so true. I really do appreciate that reframe too. And then when you're looking at the data, how difficult is this stuff to run? Like, do we have to be really good at math? Is this some basic calculations? Like, how sophisticated are these calculations really?
Not super hard. So I think if you find a real estate focused bookkeeper, they should be able to do this for you. I don't use QuickBooks myself, but I would imagine a lot of this can be done in QuickBooks. I just have a bookkeeper. Yeah. So, but if you want to learn more about that, in Bigger Pockets, we have a lot of resources. Actually, my first book is called Real Estate by the Numbers, teaches basically all the math that you need to know. It's not super heavy math. I consider it middle school math. There's nothing beyond like division, multiplying, adding, and subtracting. Mm-hmm. So as you just need to learn what the different metrics are and when to use each one.
That is so helpful. Okay. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you think is worth mentioning that comes directly from the book that will help people with their real estate investing journey?
I just encourage people, book or no book, to just try and run their own race. I think a lot of people hear about what's going on in different strategies, and it's impossible to take one investor's situation and approach to investing and apply it to your life. You have to come up with your own way of doing it. And that doesn't mean you can't learn from other people. You absolutely can, but you need to take in what other tactics people are using and apply it to your own unique situation. I really think that's the only way to be successful in real estate is to take the time, figure out what you want, and then pursue your own unique strategy. So hopefully the book helps, or hopefully this conversation helps.
I think both will for sure. Congratulations again on the book. Tell everybody where they can go to get a copy of it. It's also going to be linked in the show notes. So if you guys are not good at note-taking, you can definitely just click it there too.
It is biggerpockets.com/strategybook. You can go there. And there, if you get it in the next couple of days, you actually could get a free planner, which is basically a workbook. So you can actually write out your own strategy. There's kind of a template for your business plan that will be thrown in for free. And there's a bunch of other bonuses we're doing for the launch.
Nice. I am so pumped about that. Okay. And then before we officially part ways, are you down for some rapid fires?
Let's do it.
All right. First question for you. Where is one location you're dying to travel to?
Oh, that is such a good question. I'm very spoiled because I get to travel a lot, but New Zealand is kind of at the top of my list. I love hiking, and so I've always wanted to go there.
That would be fun. Yeah, that it's a kind of hard place to get to from what I've seen.
It's crazy. You know, we live in Europe, so we travel a lot around here. It's one of the main reasons we moved here. But so we've focused on that. It's, I think it was like 33 hours from here. Oh. I think it's a little closer from the States, but man, that's a rough one.
That's brutal. Yeah,
you got to go for a long time. I feel like it's got to be like 3 weeks at least.
It's got to be over a week at least, you know, like that's a long one.
For sure.
Okay. My next question for you, what is one book you find yourself gifting to others most often, aside from your own, of course?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, let me see. I have some of my favorites here. I really am a big fan of Brené Brown. I don't know if you read any of her books, but Daring Greatly is a really good book. I've got it right here. I think a lot of investing focuses on sort of like the tactical stuff, but so much of it is emotional and motivational. And I think she does a really good job of helping figure out how you want to lead your life and, you know, be a leader in your own business and that sort of stuff. So I'm a big fan of hers.
I love that. Okay. Next question for you. What's one purchase you recently made that has made your life better?
A Dyson vacuum. Oh, I love it. I've like wanted it for years and I finally just bought it. And I don't know, it sparks joy for me. It's like such a silly thing, but I just now I like vacuuming.
What, which one did you go with?
It was whatever was on sale. I think it's like a few model years old. It's like a V12, maybe. I think they're probably up to like V15, but it was like half price and it still works great.
Perfect. That's, I actually have a Dyson too. And the first week I got that sucker, I was like, everyone, like, this is the best. I'm like, oh my God, I'm such a millennial. Like when you get excited about cleaning products, I'm like, I think that's a sign of getting old.
It totally is. I'm with you. I don't even like cleaning. I'm not one of those people, but for some reason, this thing, it does it for me.
That's amazing. Okay. My last question for you, in your opinion, what is the secret to financial success?
I guess I would say just discipline. It's kind of a broad topic, but I think it applies to a lot of different parts of financial success, whether it's saving, increasing your earning potential, investing. And for me, discipline really comes down to just getting crystal clear about what you want. Mm-hmm. I find that it's very easy to be disciplined, at least for me, when you know exactly what you're trying to accomplish. And I think where people generally get stuck or lack motivation is they have these vague notions of what they want to accomplish. And that isn't super motivating. And so if you struggle with discipline and are focused on it, I think really thinking hard and getting very specific about what you're trying to accomplish financially, that could be really helpful.
I love that. What a beautiful way to wrap up this conversation. Dave, thanks again for hanging out. It was so fun to learn from you, and congratulations again on the book.
Thanks, Whitney. This was a lot of fun.
Okay, what were your takeaways? Did you enjoy this episode? I know I definitely did. One of my biggest takeaways was the conversation around business partners and how the different areas, you know, skill, time, money, how all of those things are very valuable. And so if you don't have money, then don't necessarily diminish your ability to be a good partner. I think it's so important. I think that's something that we often overlook. I would love to hear from you. What was your specific takeaway? Tag me on Instagram. I'm at Whitney_Hansen_co. Let me know that you're listening in and tell me a little bit about what your takeaways were from this episode. That is it for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. I appreciate you, and I will see you on Friday for 5 Tip Friday or next week for another episode of the Money Nerds Podcast. Bye.